This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and we welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is Luke 12:32, where Jesus says, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." I've recently gone through another paradigm shift in the way that I look at Jesus, and I believe that this shift is significant. Just to sum it up, Jesus and his message, they were not outside of the economically disadvantaged and subordinated in his society. Jesus' teachings actually emerged from within this community. Jesus was not speaking to people whose daily experience he didn't share firsthand with them. Jesus was speaking to and with his own peers. In Howard Thurman's privately published volume of poems called The Greatest of These, Thurman writes this poem: "His days were nurtured in great hostilities, focused upon his kind, the sons of Israel. There was no moment in all his years when he was free." Jesus, we have to remember, was a poor Jew. He was oppressed on two counts. Number one, being from the community of the poor. And then number two, he was part of the politically subordinated Jewish people who were being ruled by the Romans. So he understood firsthand the implications of what he was teaching. And although he was a Jewish male within his Jewish patriarchal society, he chose to stand in solidarity with Jewish women. You can see this in Matthew 9:22, John 8:10, Luke 15:8, Luke 10:42. Mark 10:11 and Mark 15:40. And he also voluntarily chose a life of solidarity with people who were socially marginalized, including folks like the eunuchs of Matthew 19:12. And he was saying things like there was room in his new world for them too, even though many in his day considered them to be unclean. You can find them being excluded from the Mosaic community in Deuteronomy 23:1. You can see them included in the Jesus community in Acts 8, 36-39, and you can cross-reference that with Isaiah 56, verse 3. It's as one of the least of these that Jesus spoke to his peers about the topics that we're looking at this week. And the topic that we're going to be focusing on mostly is the continual war that is carried out on the nerves of the oppressed people that cause them to live in a perpetual state of fear. And there's three types of fear that we're going to be considering. Number one is the fear of going without. Number two, the fear of violence. And number three, the fear of isolation, helplessness, and insignificance. So let's look at the first one first, fear of going without. Jesus says in Matthew 6, and this is a rather long passage, 25 through 34, he says, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, 'What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?' For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." And I want to point out here that Jesus was not teaching the economically oppressed to sit back and do nothing. Notice the phrase, "seek first his kingdom and his righteousness." Jesus was speaking to a people who had precious little, and security was one of their chief concerns. And Jesus is here inspiring them to risk even their own temporary security to make active advancements towards this new world that Jesus was calling the kingdom. He was casting a vision in their imagination of a just world, his righteousness, he calls it, a world of justice where all oppression, injustice, and violence is put right. And he was assuring them that if they would pursue a world that is just and safe and compassionate for everyone, then in the end result would be that they would see a world where everyone's needs would ultimately be met. And this passage directly refers I think, to the mentality that so many downtrodden people have, this idea of a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, and so they don't take any risks. Those in control use present security, even if it's a facade, to dissuade oppressed people from questioning or threatening the status quo. What little security they have, they want to hold on to. The second fear I want to look at is the fear of violence. In Matthew 10, 26 through 30, and this is my own personal translation, Jesus says, "So do not be afraid of them, for there is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What is whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. Do not be afraid of those who destroy your external well-being, but cannot touch your inner well-being. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy your entire well-being, both your outer as well as your inner well-being in Gehenna." And remember, Gehenna, I believe, is Jesus' reference to what was going to be taking place in AD 70, Jerusalem's annihilation by following a militaristic Messiah. He goes on, he says, Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside of your Father's care. For even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. And here Jesus is speaking with those whose internalized fear of their oppressors, and remember that's the Romans, it had driven them to also internalize hatred of the Romans, as well as the wealthy Jewish aristocrats who had sold out to complicity with the empire. And the zealots would have only been at one end of the spectrum of those that Jesus is speaking to. All across the spectrum of those disgruntled with the system, there were those who believed they could overthrow Rome by taking up a sword, like Judah Maccabees during the Maccabean Revolt. And in Matthew 5, 38 through 41, Jesus offers this audience another way, the way of transformative enemy love. And Jesus foresaw that if his people, if they chose the way of violence towards their violent oppressors, that choice would only end in Rome's annihilation of the Jewish people. And this is exactly what we see transpired in the Jewish-Roman War of 66 to 69, and climaxed in Jerusalem's destruction in 70. Jesus is offering his peers here what I believe is a force more powerful than violence. It's a force that's rooted not in hatred of one's enemies and a desire to defeat one's enemies, but it's one that's rooted in love and a desire to transform one's enemies. Jesus' teachings on nonviolence, they were not passive. They did involve a non-cooperation in some scenarios. And they also included nonviolent direct action, which is active. It takes a risk, and it involves creative imagination. Both non-cooperation, which can be viewed as passive, and direct action, which is most definitely active, both of those have their appropriate use in nonviolently seeking Jesus' new world, again, that he called the kingdom, and its justice or its righteousness for everyone. But where all of this must begin is deliverance from the fear of those in control of what Dorothy Day called the present dirty, rotten system. And Jesus is offering a way for us to transcend our fear of what others can do to our external realities and be internally immunized against the fear that so often leads to a loss of integrity where we have to be deceitful or to embrace, even worse, hatred of our enemies. And this is what Jesus means by destroying one's body and their soul as well. Fear, falsehood, and hate have the power to kill you internally as well as externally, and they produce what I would call a living and enduring hell. So take for a moment, go back and reread the above passage in Matthew 10 with all of this in mind, and we'll consider Jesus' words through the works of Thurman in just a moment. The last fear I want to look at is the fear of isolation, helplessness, and insignificance. In Luke 12:32, Jesus says, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." In each of these, there's a theme of not being afraid. And the adjective here for little flock, is mikros. It refers to not just the size of a flock, but also to one's dignity. By comparing the oppressed to a flock, Jesus is purposefully, I believe, drawing attention to the way that, like sheep, they had been objectified and dehumanized and are simply part of someone else's net worth, their balance sheet. And by referring to them as little flock, he's addressing the dignity that they lack even among others who are being objectified and dehumanized. Little flocks are worth far less than large flocks. And Jesus was speaking to the least among the disadvantaged, the lowest among the community of the low. And yet Jesus says, it is to you, little flock, among the flocks, that the heart of the universe is pleased to give you this new world. These words of assurance are especially for those who are multiply oppressed in the community of the oppressed. Modern examples would be, let's say, women of color among white feminists or transgender people in the LGBT community. There's something deeply humiliating and foundationally damaging to the self-respect and personal dignity of anyone who cannot appeal to anyone for protection from their oppressors. And I want to share three passages as we close this week from Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited, that I think are relevant. And I cannot say it better than Thurman did. I'll simply share his insight here. I've only edited Thurman's words to make them more gender inclusive, but these are the three passages. There are few things more devastating than to have it burned into you that you do not count, that no provisions are made for the literal protection of your person. A person's conviction that they are God's child automatically tends to shift the basis of their relationship with all their fellows. They recognize at once that to fear another person, whatever may be that person's power over them, is a basic denial of the integrity of their life. It lifts that person to a place of preeminence that belongs to God and God alone. Those who fear are literally delivered to destruction. The second passage is, to the child of God, a scale of values becomes available to which people are measured and their true significance determined. Even the threat of violence, with the possibility of death that it carries, is recognized for what it is, merely the threat of violence with a death potential. Such a person recognizes that death cannot possibly be the worst thing in the world. There are some things that are worse than death. To deny one's own integrity of personality in the presence of the human challenge is one of those things. And here's the last passage. The core of the analysis of Jesus is that every person is a child of God, the God of life that sustains all nature and guarantees all the intricacies of the life process itself. Jesus suggests that it is quite unreasonable to assume that God, whose creative activity is expressed even in such details as the hairs of a person's head, would exclude from God's concern the life, the vital spirit of the persons themselves. This idea that God is mindful of the individual is of tremendous import in dealing with fear as a disease. In this world, the socially disadvantaged person is constantly given a negative answer to the most important personal questions upon which mental health depends. Who am I and what am I? The first question has to do with a basic self-estimate, a profound sense of belonging, of counting. If a person feels that he does not belong in the way in which it is perfectly normal for other people to belong, then they develop a deep sense of insecurity. When this happens to a person, it provides the basic material for what the psychologists call an inferiority complex. It is for a person to have no sense of personal inferiority as such, but at the same time to be dogged by a sense of social inferiority. The awareness of being a child of God tends to stabilize the ego and results in new courage, fearlessness, and power. I have seen it happen again and again. Dr. King, Martin Luther King, spoke on fear and faith in this way. King, and this is from King's sermon that he preached at Ebenezer Baptist Church on April 30th, 1967. He said, "Now it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated. When you tell the truth and take a stand, sometimes it means that you will walk the streets with a burdened heart. Sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking a daddy, 'Why do you have to go to jail so much?' And I've long since learned that to be a follower to the Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it for truth, bear it for justice, bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination, and I have not lost faith. I am not in despair, because I know that there is a moral order. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I can still sing, "We shall overcome," because Carlyle was right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant was right. The truth pressed to the earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell was right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lay down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of that old Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we're getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation will not rise up against nation, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more. Jesus' new world this week of compassion and justice for all, I do believe is possible. We must, just like Jesus, not lose faith in humanity. Jesus spoke as one who himself belonged to the community of the oppressed, and his way to this new world begins, as we've seen over and over this week, with a call to abandon fear. All that might follow begins with this first step. For as perfect love drives out fear, fear also drives out perfect love. And it is love for all and only love that compels us to sit at Jesus' shared table and opens the way to that world where the heart of the universe has become the heart of us all. Heart group application this week. This week, I want you to go back and spend some time each day contemplating Jesus' words in Matthew 6, 25 through 34, Matthew 10, 26 through 30, and Luke 12, 32. Number two, as you do this, journal your thoughts, your questions, your insights, any breakthroughs that you have as you engage with these passages each day. And then number three, I want you to share your journal insights with your heart group, your shared table for discussion and feedback this coming week. Here's to a safer, more compassionate world for us all. Many voices, one shared table, one new world. Wherever this finds you this week, keep letting go of fear, keep living in love, and listening with compassion till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. I love each of you. I'll see you next week.